Today on Maine Calling, what it's like to live with a disability in Maine. More than 200,000 Mainers live with a disability. Most face challenges in this rural state navigating transportation, housing, and employment. They also often confront being stereotyped and misunderstood. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, people with different kinds of disabilities join me to talk about their everyday life experiences, from joys to challenges, and they'll share what they wish others understood. Do you live with a disability? What do you want others to know about your experience here in Maine? This program wraps up our year-long series, Ready and Able, Living with a Disability in Maine. It is being streamed live with an ASL interpreter on Maine Calling's Facebook page and Maine Public's YouTube channel. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Throughout our year-long series, Ready and Able, we've examined different aspects of living with a disability in Maine. Today's show asks the broad question, what is it like to live with a disability? We'll discuss what people might not understand about the challenges and joys. We'll hear from people with different disabilities, sensory, physical, intellectual, and more. Our guest today for the hour, Kim Moody, who is Executive Director of Disability Rights Maine, and Crystal Emerson, who is parent of a child with a disability. We want to note that we are streaming this program live on Maine Public's YouTube channel and Maine Calling's Facebook page. Again, Maine Public's YouTube channel and Maine Calling's Facebook page. Our ASL English interpreter for this program is Sid Pollard. She is signing and also providing voice interpretation during the program. And we invite you to join the conversation. What is your experience of living with a disability or having a loved one with a disability? What do you wish others knew? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you, both of you, and welcome to Maine Calling. Kim, welcome back to Maine Calling. And Kim, I'm going to start with you. You know, we've spent this year examining different topics related to living with a disability, such as transportation, housing, employment, and those are all very important. But today, to sum up this series, I'm hoping that we can just kind of get real and human, have a conversation that's not necessarily about policy and solutions and resources, but how we relate to one another, what it's like in 2025, almost 2026, to live with a disability in Maine, and what people with disabilities want others to know. So, Kim, we usually turn to you as an expert and a nonprofit leader. But I'm asking now, could you tell us about your disability and what it means in your day-to-day life?
Sure, Jennifer. Thank you. I want to just say thank you quickly to you and to Maine Public for this year-long series. It has been a great pleasure. And I think for me, there are a couple of themes going on broadly. Like you've heard me say, if you ask one person what it's like to live with a disability, you're asking that one person. And that's it, because we're all different. But I think the biggest thing that comes across for me is that society long ago decided that they thought, or everyone thought, that we should be fixed. And none of us really feel like we need fixing. And so it's interesting, though, arguably, me wearing a prosthesis when I ride my e-bike or downhill ski might be me being fixed in your eyes or other people's eyes. But for me, it's just easier and safer if I wear that artificial arm. But you wouldn't believe the number of people over the last 30 something years who have felt the need to ask me, why, Kim, why don't you get a prosthesis? Or people who knew I used to wear one asking me why I don't wear it anymore. And I've never said this, but the real answer to that is it's none of your beeswax why I don't or do what I do. It's kind of like me asking you why you don't wear a bra. It's that personal, really. So I was born with, I think I've told you before, I was born without my left arm in Brunswick, Maine. And way back then, 63 years ago, I was considered a crippled child. And so we've come a long way since then. But still, and you and I have talked about how some people identify as a person with a disability and others identify as a disabled person. And that kind of gets at how far we've come in this movement. And, I mean, people still ask, if you could change your disability, would you change it? And I don't really think about that because there are lots of things about myself that I wish I could change, just like the rest of us. I think the main theme for me is that we are just like everybody else. We want friends and family and a job and enough money to get by and laughter and love. And we do face common barriers as people with disabilities, and we face common discrimination too. And that's why we have a movement,
And
really.
this has been really one of the tricky things of this whole year, Kim, and I'm sure of your life's work, is that one of the big messages here is that people with disabilities are people and they're not different. So yet we've just done a series on what it's like to live with a disability. So we're making it out that everybody with a disability is somehow different, and it's tricky, right?
Yes, it is tricky. I think that everybody with a disability is different, just like all of us are different. But the fact that we, like I said last, the fact that we face discrimination and we face exclusion from society does set us aside and means that we have to have a movement, a disability civil rights movement, to make change because we've had to fight to get educated and to get employed and to get included.
Ma'am, give us a sense, Kim, of what you found that other people don't understand.
Oh, I guess just that, what we're talking about, Jennifer, that we're just like everybody else. We just have this other thing going on, right? We have this other thing, and sometimes that other thing causes us pain or costs a lot of money or causes us inconvenience or causes us not to be able to do a certain thing. But we just have that other thing going on. But doesn't everybody have a bunch of things going on? I mean, I think that's what really we want people to know, that we're just like you. We just have another thing going on.
Crystal, you are joining us today on your son's behalf because of all that you've experienced as a parent with a neurodivergent child in school. I understand his disability is not outwardly visible, correct? And that has its own set of challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that once he is actively struggling and actively dysregulated, it's obvious. But a lot of the times he is looked at as just being defiant or just being manipulative or really just trying to kind of control a situation. And so that's been really challenging in the public school setting, because, the school wasn't necessarily seeing those situations that we were at home at first. And so there was a lot of, let's not label, let's not, rock the boat if we don't need to. We're not seeing anything here, so we need to, take in his evaluations. And it just quickly snowballed and escalated to where he then was not able to kind of maintain and mask and kind of push through his disability. And that led to being restrained, being secluded, just awful kind of experience. And we're still trying to unravel that for him, even several years later.
I imagine as a parent, there's a lot to learn about your child's disability. And I mean, for any parent, there's so much to learn and how to best help your child. But there's also the personal experience of a personal experience of what do I need to know? How do I love this child? How do I navigate the system? It must all feel like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I can't even imagine how overwhelming that must all be.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we first started this, I remember going to our doctor and asking for help, and she was wonderful, very welcoming and open. Unfortunately, the wait list outside of her office was a year out. Things got lost in the process. And so while we're waiting for this year-long wait list, we're thinking we're on the list. Several months go into that year, and come to find out that the referral never finalized on the receiving end. And so we ended up being knocked back down and having another wait for that. So it was a total year and a half when we, as parents, were at that kind of end of our rope of, okay, something's going on here. How do I help best support him, our other children, ourselves? So that was really tough. And then, we started our process with being very open, being very collaborative, looking to the experts to help support us, waiting for the wait list, waiting to get in for the evaluations, and then really finding that some of these mindsets are very already made up. They already kind of had I guess, treatment idea of what we needed to do and what my son needed to do. And that went against everything that was feeling natural and everything that we were seeing. If we did, made things worse. And if we did things another way, it helped support him to the point where he felt safe and then could move forward with progress. But I would say the biggest challenge and worry outside of, how do I support him at home and emotionally and safety, was really trying to navigate the education system. It seems like it's set up to protect parents and protect the students. And I'm not saying that it isn't. I'm saying that my experience or his experience seemed more so to just exhaust us, to kind of make us go through loop. Jump through hoops and do all of these things, rather than really looking at what does our son need. Rather, it was tied to money. Is there enough funding for this? Is there do we have enough room to do that? How can we accommodate this way? You want him in general ed, but how do we do that here, with all of this or that he needs? And so that's been a real struggle of trying to feel like he is seen outside of what on a piece of paper is being said are his struggles. And we've really, really had to work on, even ourselves as parents, of trusting him. We were asking him to do all of these things that didn't feel comfortable to him, that made him feel unsafe. And then when he would tell us, I can't do this, or I don't feel comfortable doing that. And they're just simple things, right? Like getting through the day, brushing teeth, going to school. We were pushing him through all of that, and that just continued to kind of compound. And when we started respecting what he was saying and really helping him tap into what he needed, that was when a lot of the progress started to shift for us.
Thank you for sharing that, Crystal. Calling in now is Kyle Miller, who is visually impaired and works for the Iris Network in a variety of roles and is calling us from Portland. Thanks so much for calling in, Kyle.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. Tell us about the type of visual impairment you have. Have you been visually impaired your entire life?
Yes. So I have been visually impaired since birth, and the correct or the proper diagnosis that I have is the acronym is CVI. It's a cortical vision impairment. So it doctors really don't know what my vision impairment really is. So it's just a broad term saying, hey, you're vision impaired, but you can still do whatever you want to do. Like I still go and I'm working, I play sports, I'm on a men's rugby team, and we and I still play, and I just live life to the best of my abilities.
Tell us some of the things you wish people understood about being blind and about life in Maine.
So being blind in Maine is just, you got to live your life. If you want to go out and about and travel around, make sure you do it safely with whatever mobility devices that you want to use or you have access to, and just live your best life. If you like going to concerts, go to concerts. If you like being active and athletic and playing sports, find a rec league that is open to having a person with vision impairments or totally blind on a sports team or on a rec league team, or going to the gym and lifting weights with your friends, and just have fun. Being blind does not mean that your life should end, basically.
How do you find that others are? You say you played on a rugby team. Is the rest of the rugby team welcoming and
yes.
Yeah, they are.
Yes.
And I'm going to ask you, Kyle. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I am the only vision impaired person athlete on the rugby team and in my entire division. So
I'm going to ask you a question and Kim and I have talked about this in the past, and I think she'll probably want to weigh in. One of the things that I understand really frustrates a lot of people who live with disabilities is when they're treated as though they are super inspirational for doing the things they do with their disability. And Kyle, I'm wondering if people ever said to you, "You're so inspirational. How do you play rugby even though you can't see?"
I follow other big people. I get it all the time. I get it from all the gym things that I do as well. I just say thank you. I smile. I nod. I say, you can do this too if you put your mind to it. This is not just a me thing. This is what I like. This is what I'm using my abilities towards. My interest is in this. So I'm gonna push this. If you find that inspirational, good for you. But I'm living my life how I want to live it, and I want to live it to the fullest potential.
All right, and
so I don't find it inspirational at all. I find it, hey, I'm gonna do this. So I don't care if you find it inspirational or not. It's cool that you do, but it's my life.
Yeah. So it doesn't really offend you, but you don't really care.
No.
Okay, and I'm going to turn to Kim and ask her to follow up on that, because you and others have said that, you know, it's sort of like this trope, and you know, people who live with disabilities hear it all the time. Oh, you're so inspirational. But Kim, as we started this whole conversation with, life is hard enough, right? And if somebody does have a disability and they're still navigating life and doing so beautifully and playing rugby, you know, it is inspirational. So, Kim, talk us through this a little bit.
Well, I get that. And I agree with Kyle. I think we mainly we laugh about it. At the time, I think there's some expectation that we will let people know that we're just living our best lives and that we don't mean to be inspirational. But I've told you, Jennifer, you know, I play pickleball a lot and I'm okay. I hold my own. But my God, from the way that people react to me wherever, if I go someplace new, you would think I were a 5.0. You're amazing, Kim. And, you know, I'm not really. I'm just having fun.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Kyle, thank you so much for calling in. Kyle Miller has a visual impairment. He works with the Iris Network and, as we just heard, plays rugby. We're going to take a break. This is Maine Calling, our number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking with a number of people today who have different disabilities and getting their personal perspective on what it's like to live with a disability. What misconceptions do others have? What are some of the positive sides and what are some of the negative sides? With me, Crystal Emerson, who is the mother of a child with a disability, and Kim Moody, Executive Director of Disability Rights Maine. Share your comments and questions and share experiences that you have encountered. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And a reminder that today's program is streaming live on Maine Public's YouTube channel and Maine Public's Facebook page with an ASL English interpreter. Joining us now is Barbara Malinowski. She is a mom with achondroplasia, whose four children are also little people. She is with Little People of America, where she serves as District 1 Director. Thank you so much for giving us a call, Barbara.
Hi, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
And did I pronounce everything correctly?
Pretty close. Achondroplasia and Malinowski, so not so
okay,
bad.
Okay,
pretty
great.
Big words.
Great. You know, let's talk about terminology for a second.
Sure.
What is the preferred term to use someone to describe your category of disability?
Little person. Little person is the best term.
Okay. And so, and we have seen in recent years on television, especially, really more of a higher profile for little people. And I'm wondering if sort of having a spotlight, having a bit of amplification has changed what it's like for little people living in America.
It has in some ways. I mean, there's more of an acceptance. I think when it first started, like with the show Little People, Big World, it was a little more voyeuristic. And like when I would go out shopping, people would often mistake me for Amy Roloff, like out in public. And she and I look nothing alike. And they'd be like, oh, it's amazing that you can grocery shop and they drive. Do you know that they drive and they go grocery shopping? Meanwhile, I was out shopping and driving and I had a kid just like they did. And I would look at them kind of like, yeah, it's amazing. Like I was doing the exact same thing that they were doing on television. And they were like amazed by what was on television versus I was living the same parallel life. So it was very interesting because it was they were modeling the same thing that I was doing. So it was quite a contrast that it was amazing on television, but they didn't see the parallel of it happening right in front of them. But over time, now that there's so many shows, there's not as much of a shock value. And also there's been more, they've become more, commonplace, I guess, and less voyeuristic because there's also been more educational shows like the Seven Little Johnstons take advantage of it and look at it as a more educational and give more information that's more educational. And then there's more movies that have more standardized roles versus Elf-like and all that other stuff. So which is more appreciative.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm wondering how you're raising four children who are all little people as well. And I'm wondering how, what are you telling them about your own childhood? What are you teaching them about how to navigate the world?
One step at a time, keep your head up high, adjust. We just have trouble reaching things, seriously. We use step stools around the house, try to be confident, believe in yourself. A lot of the same stuff you would teach any other child. It's all about self-confidence and believing in yourself. In school, we have IEPs and 504 plans to make sure things are accessible because that is the most important thing for safety in school, to make sure that things are accessible and to make sure physically. And then outside of that, it's about what's inside ourselves internally and mentally to make sure we have self-confidence and to make sure that we can succeed that way. And the self-confidence is what gets us far.
Barbara, what would you say to others about treating a little person with respect? Just very basic day-to-day tips. Would you recommend, for example, that if somebody is speaking to someone who's small, that perhaps they sit or lean over or not? Would that feel insulting? And also, you know, if someone's in a grocery store, would you like it if somebody says, can I help you get something? Or do you feel like, no, leave me alone?
That is a very interesting question. Each person is different in that manner. And there's no harm in asking. And each person may react differently to that. But of course, would you like some help? And don't be surprised if some people say yes and some people may say no. And in regards to sitting, standing, or squatting in addressing somebody, each person also is very different. And in October, which is Dwarfism Awareness Month, a lot of people will post on their Facebook page and stuff sharing information. And when people share that information, we actually did something about that, sharing things about that. And a lot of people shared how they prefer to be addressed and whether it's standing and squatting. I personally prefer if somebody sits when they're not equal height to me, when they're addressing me, because that way we're seeing eye to eye. Because if you're squatting, often an average size person squatting is usually addressing a child. Like a parent addresses a child by squatting. And so that is more of a parent talking to a child. And I'm not a child. I'm an adult.
Before we let you go, Barbara, anything else you'd like others to know?
The best way to address a person, a little person, would be by name. If you know our name, that's the best way to address or refer to us.
Okay, so now I'm really, I'm not sure I want to know the answer, but it wouldn't occur to me to address you any other way. How have you been addressed?
Shorty, a lot of, in the past, the M word, which I actually don't want to actually say. It ends with, starts with an M, ends with a T, the D is in the middle. It was actually back in 1957 when Billy Barty first founded the organization, Little People of America. It was actually first titled Midgets of America. Mm. And so there it goes. That's how we were, you know, it's a derogatory term.
Yeah.
And that's often
it's a shame to have to say that out loud, but I'm sure there are people right now thinking, oh gosh, I didn't know that. And thank you for telling me that. I didn't know that was derogatory.
Yeah.
Barbara, thank you so much for calling in and taking part in this conversation today. Barbara Malinowski is a little person, as are her four children. We're going to go now to Kathy Buston, who is a mom and grandmother in Hollowell, retired from a career in disability rights advocacy. She personally experienced psychiatric services and has been a leader for psychiatric survivors. Thank you for calling in, Kathy.
Thank you, Jennifer, for including me.
Yeah, so you've lived a life in which there's been a lot of change in society. I know this is a conversation could go on for hours, but how have society's attitudes toward people with psychiatric conditions changed and not changed over your lifetime?
Well, thank you for that question. I have lived in my 63 years, 44 of them labeled with a psychiatric diagnosis, and also 36 of them working in some capacity in disability rights to advocate and educate change. And I will say that while there has been some progress, many, many things have just either stayed exactly the same. It's a little discouraging, as I think Kim can speak to as well from a career this long. Some of the misconceptions remain exactly the same, as the way that those are translated into policy level and program level approaches to what is called help remains very damaging. Mm. So I would say more specifically, for example, we have made progress, and particularly I think educating younger providers of services in the area of, you know, acknowledging people's trauma, that what happens to people is a better question and a better approach than what is wrong with someone. We tend to locate as a society whatever is happening that's causing someone extreme mental or emotional or spiritual distress as located within that person solely. Unfortunately, though, every aspect of this, the top place, the top people in charge of what approaches look like remain psychiatry. That's a medical model, and it is a model that teaches that people need their own judgment and their own voice substituted by someone else's best judgment.
Hmm.
I would say that remains the same, and the effect on individuals, both while they're in distress and as they move on, is extremely damaging.
Well, Kathy, thank you for calling in today. Kathy Buston worked in disability rights advocacy for psychiatric survivors. And something she said, Crystal, is something I want to turn to you with. This idea of a question being, what is wrong with someone? I'm guessing that that really resonates with you as a mother of a child who experiences difficulties.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was so much that Kathy said in that quick amount of time that just gave me chills. You know, when we talk about help, what does help look like to someone? And it's kind of being passed down as the best practice in one manner and not really taking into account all of the layers that someone has experienced. You know, some folks may be comfortable with other approaches, such as, you know, deep pressure or things like that, where if they've experienced some type of trauma, then touch is not going to be what helps them. And there's a lot of times where we're just meant to kind of ignore what we need. Otherwise, we're, you know, being difficult or being, you know, enabling. So there's a lot of times where when someone is kind of trying to figure out what is going on with my son, we are looked at as to blame. And that's very hard as a parent who has only ever wanted what was best for my son. There's nothing wrong with him. And when we support him in what helps him thrive, he's amazing in all aspects, but it's been incredible to watch. And so, you know, listening to some of the other stories of when someone sees, you know, Kyle as being an inspiration, it really just comes from this deep admiration of resilience of people and in awe. But also I think confidence, right? I mean, the fact that my son has experienced so much in just a short amount of time, with having everybody kind of pointing the finger back and saying, this is him and something's wrong and he needs to fix this. And yet he has these disabilities that make it challenging for him. If we weren't there to support him, I don't know where he would end up being.
We'll go to James, who's calling from Portland. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, this is James, and my sister was born when I was 5 years old, and she lived, she had a disability, a spina bifida, and initially it was a kind of a shock to the family to invite her in to be part of our family. But very shortly, we began accepting her as a person, and I think went through most of her lifetime and much of mine with great respect for her as an individual. And I guess I just wanted to say that.
James, thank you for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, or send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today is what it's like to live with a disability today in Maine. What are people's real experiences and what are misconceptions? This show is part of our year-long series, Ready and Able, Living with a Disability in Maine. Joining me for the hour are Kim Moody, who is with Disability Rights Maine, and Crystal Emerson, who has a son with a disability. We invite you to join our conversation if you're quick, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or Instagram. Please note that today's program is viewable live with ASL interpretation on Maine Public's YouTube channel and Maine Public's Facebook page. And I will go to a Facebook post. This is Jane on Facebook writes, I have an adult daughter who also has ADHD, and we laugh over shared symptoms and shared frustration with not being understood. And Kim, I'm going to turn to you with that one. The ability to laugh at how other people respond to you, how important is that?
Well, I think it's critical, especially in tough times. I think being able to laugh at ourselves and being able to laugh, as you said, at how people respond to us is really, really important. And like I said before, the whole inspiration thing trope that we've talked about in the past, we can get angry about that and waste all of that energy, or we can just sort of laugh at that and say thank you, really.
On the line with us now is Nico Gabriel. He's living with narcolepsy and also has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Thanks, Nico, for calling. And did I pronounce that right? And explain what that is.
Yeah, you did pronounce it right for the most part. It's Ehlers-Danlos. I think everyone kind of knows what narcolepsy is, that they don't tend to know that there's a different type, which is the type I have. There's the kind where you have cataplexy, you suddenly fall asleep, which people tend to know about, and then the kind where you're tired all of the time, which is the kind I have. Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is a condition where you have a lack of connective tissue in your joints and various other parts of your body. It takes many different forms depending on which kind you have, and it affects pretty much every system of the body to varying degrees.
So you have one of the disabilities that people might describe as that people are not able to see. And I'm wondering how that living with that kind of disability, not only in terms of what you can or cannot do, but how others perceive of you, what it means to live like that in today's world.
When I'm not using my mobility aid, which that is very dependent on the health and the diet and the everything about my life and the conditions of the weather, it's very, very weird. But when I'm not using my mobility aid, I feel very invisible. And I think the thing that people tend to struggle with me is the way that I talk about my treatment and the way that I treat myself and the way that I am able to have access to medications. I have medication dependence as a thing that I struggle with on a daily basis. And I think when you walk into a pharmacy versus when you use mobility aid to get into the pharmacy, or you're very clearly disabled in some physical capacity, people treat you very differently. So if I'm in trying to get a prescription from a doctor, or trying to get it picked up at the pharmacy, or even just trying to talk about it with somebody, people tend to treat me very differently, and they don't tend to understand why this is so important to me, why I need these things so much if you can't see why I'm disabled.
That's interesting. So when you are using a mobility device, people are more compassionate, it sounds like.
Yeah, and then I don't even, like, I take a stimulant for my narcolepsy, but I don't take prescription pain medications or anything like that. It's just, like, for the narcolepsy, like, people tend to dislike when people are addicted to stimulants so much that they won't give stimulants to people who aren't addicted to stimulants, if that makes sense, which is really frustrating because there's a very, I'm not going to go into a tangent, but a very big lack of support for people who are addicted to stimulants, and they would much rather deny anyone those treatments and be kind of rude to them instead of just being compassionate to either the disabled person who needs them or the addict who is dependent on them for other reasons.
Oh my gosh, that's complicated. Well, Nico, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience. Nico Gabriel has narcolepsy as well as Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and other disabilities. I'm going to go to Joseph, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Joseph. Go ahead.
Well, hello. And I just want to say thank you for taking my call, because the thing is, I'm an LCPC, a counselor, clinician, and for a lot of people, it's kind of hard for them to speak up, but at the same time, it makes good advocacy for at least on this dialogue that we're having. And I want to say that with, in the grand scheme of things, especially at society, how we treat people with, say, disabilities, or even, say, I call it more issues than disabilities, because that has a negative stigma tied to it. And it's trying to give people the concept that they do have abilities out there. They're not just disabled and they can't do stuff.
Yeah, Joseph, thanks for saying that. And Kim, I'm going to turn back to you. Interesting what Joseph says. As a counselor, he prefers the word issues than disabilities. You're executive director of an organization called Disabilities Rights Maine. And the word does start with dis, so go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think it's up to us. I mean, I think I can call myself a disabled woman or a woman with a disability. And I mean, we're often asked that question, which do you prefer? Do you identify as a disabled person, or do you identify as a person first and then a disability? I think it is up to us, each and every one of us, not anybody who doesn't have a disability.
Yeah. And what Joseph said reminded me of what you said at the beginning of the show, is that, look, we all go through life with issues.
Right.
Right. Joseph, thanks for your call. Joining us now, Sitara Sheikh, who is co-president of the Maine Association of the Deaf. She is deaf and has worked in vocational rehabilitation. Thank you for joining us, Sitara.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
You know, we've spent so much time broadly here on this show talking about challenges, but there are also joys. Will you share with us challenges and joys of living without hearing?
Sure. You know, we who are deaf and hard of hearing in the community, we have a collective of many of those shared experiences where we can support one another. And, you know, there are, of course, a lot of challenges, issues, things that we work, you know, against in the system globally. We've seen a lot of gains over the years, of course, that we've seen. But, you know, there are some things that have not changed or are slower to change. And, you know, so I think what's really excellent about some technology with our virtual platform these days is the increase in the ability to be able to engage remotely, you know, when we think about opportunities that we have all over the state and being able to do that visually, for example, Zoom, to be able to be part of a radio show like this with an interpreter is fantastic. We never would have been able to do that in the past, you know. Of course, there are stigmas that still exist. And, you know, somebody who is deaf sometimes is not immediately a visible disability. They may or may not use their voice, but often there's stereotypes and assumptions. So, for example, if you don't speak, they assume that your intellect is also impacted. And they assume, you know, this idea of, I mean, the idea of, can you read my lips? And, you know, 30% of the information is really accessible on the lips. And so they assume, you know, some people are really very good at being able to do that, but it's very fatiguing in making those connections cognitively and the amount of work. You know, imagine if you were in a room where everybody was speaking a different language and you don't know French, for example, and they're all speaking French, and you want to be able to connect with somebody. You know, having access to an interpreter is a possibility virtually, but it's not perfect because sometimes, let's say, the connection freezes up and things like that. So you're still missing out on information, even though you have that access in theory. So we are constantly having to chase information in a lot of ways. And so that is the huge challenge for us as a deaf and hard of hearing community. Do you have equitable information? And we're constantly educating the general public and advocating as an organization to work for systemic changes in the world. So trying to break down those misconceptions, the attitudes that we're facing, and you know, we want those equitable opportunities for our deaf and hard of hearing individuals, deaf blind individuals, or deaf with additional disabilities. So it's what we're doing.
Sitara, what's something you really wish that those who are not deaf would understand about deaf culture?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, we're a collective, and but as was mentioned earlier in the show, we are all human, and it's just a different way to communicate with our full language of American Sign Language here in the United States. We want change. We want respect from those who are not deaf or hard of hearing. We want them to take the time to listen to us. And, you know, if we're asking for an accommodation or if we are advocating for ourselves in what we need, please respect that. And, you know, what we find is that, you know, many systems make decisions for us. For example, they say, well, you will have to use a virtual interpreter, even if we've asked for an in-person interpreter. You know, and those assumptions create barriers rather than break them down. So when we're asking for things that we need in order to make sure that we can be fully informed and have that informed decision-making possibility, please respect that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sitara Sheikh with the Maine Association of the Deaf. Going quickly to Ava, who's calling from Presque Isle. Ava, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm someone who is recently become disabled, one from an autoimmune disorder that is incredibly rare, you know, fewer than 100 are diagnosed in a year. And that makes it tough because people don't understand what the disability is. They don't understand that I get fatigued faster than other people do, and I can't regenerate that energy as fast. And then recently, I ended up with what they call CIDP, the fancy word for saying chronic Guillain-Barré. And my hands and feet and legs and arms started tingling and having numbness and becoming unable to walk. And it's very interesting to watch people who have known me for years being fully able and helping them to suddenly needing them to help me to walk. And it's been fascinating to see the transition, you know, to me in a wheelchair and then learning how to walk again and even be able to get my foot an inch off the ground.
Oh, Ava,
And
I wish
eventually
that
that
we
could
had
occur.
so much more time to talk with you, but I wish you the best of luck as you navigate your new body reality. And Kim, we have less than a minute left. I've heard you so many times say disability is a part of life. Ava illustrates that. What would you say to Ava, and what would you like to say as we say goodbye?
Well, just really wish you the very best, Ava, and good luck with this transition in your life. And I really have appreciated this. We learned about the M word that's like the R word. We learned about it's better to ask what happened to you than what's wrong with you. We learned that ask the person how they want to be communicated with. And so I think a lot of really important messages came through today, Jennifer.
Yeah. Well, thank you, all of you. And Kim, thank you for all of your help throughout this series. You too, Sid Pollard. And it was Sid's voice you heard earlier when we were talking with Sitara. And Crystal Emerson, also with us today, the mother of a child with a disability. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. We had help from Maine Public's TV production coordinator, Nick Godfrey. Again, thank you to our ASL English interpreter, Sid Pollard, with Mary Jane Grant Sign Language Interpreting Services. You can watch today's program again on Maine Public's YouTube channel. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about how we get our news today. It's not on the evening news anymore, and really not usually in newspapers. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.